Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 24, The Continental Army. The last couple episodes, we've spent our time talking about the Battle of Bunker Hill. The Battle of Bunker Hill was fought on the hills around Boston, where the British are besieged, and they're once again fighting a colonial militia. And it's just days before that battle that the Continental Congress will agree that we need to form a Continental Army. Now, it did take time for word to reach from Philadelphia to Boston, so the militiamen that are fighting on Bunker Hill have no idea that this piece of legislation has passed. So they're still colonial militia. The Continental Army will form, and it will really start up when Washington takes command. You see, 3 days before the Battle of Bunker Hill, they say, we're going to form a Continental Army. The next morning, they say, the man that we want to head this Continental Army is George Washington. This tall, soft-spoken Virginian was going to be the man to lead the American soldiers in a war against Britain. A lot of people ask why. Now, the first you have to look at who nominates him. It's not Virginians. It's actually John Adams and Ben Franklin, one man from New England and another man from Pennsylvania. So why don't they elect someone from their home colonies? Well, they both were very educated men and knew that we are fighting this to free all 13 colonies. So the troops have to come from all 13 colonies, and the commander should not come from Massachusetts or New England, where they have been doing a lion's share of the fighting. They want every colony to feel that they have someone to support in this fight. So as part of the deal, each colony had to meet a certain quota for soldiers that they're going to commit to the Continental Army. Now, we're going to get later on in years in the war, and we are going to see that there are points when enlistments are very low, and then the enlistments are rather high. Another thing is the term enlistment. We are going to talk about it quite often. If you were signing an enlistment term, at least in the early days of the war, you could sign something as simple as a 60 to 90 day enlistment to something as a 1 to 3 year enlistment. A lot of those long-term enlistments were, in so many words, there, and you were basically there until the end of the war. Now, in the early days of the war, a lot of the enlistments were coming out of New England. So 75 and 76, where a lot of the fighting is in New England, continental enlistments are coming from New England. At the height of the war, from 77 to 80, you have multiple British armies invading from different areas. So there is a much higher level of enlistment from all over the colonies. The highest number of soldiers that was seen in the Continental Army as a whole was during 1779. Washington had in total at his command something like 25,000 men. Now, the unique thing about that is 1779 is a year where there's little to no major battles happening. So maybe that has something to do with it. And, you know, the lowest being about 4,000 during the winter at Valley Forge. Now, we'll see a stark decline in enlistments, not from any battles really, because by 1781, for most part, if you know your Revolutionary War history, the major conflicts of the war have passed. It's not that they're just out of men because, you know, they're all battled out or whatever. It's because Congress is bankrupt and they cannot pay for soldiers to, you know, continue their enlistments in the Continental Army. They put it on the states, and a lot of the states were running out of money or just didn't want to pay for the Continental Army anymore. So you saw a stark decline in the amount of soldiers during those ending days of the war. Now, to join the Continental Army, you had to be 16 years of age. You could join the Continentals at 15, but you had to have parental approval to do so. So your parents basically had to say, yes, you can take my 15-year-old son so he can join the war. Now, when you get into the Continental Army, you would probably don a coat. It wasn't always the blue coat that we're accustomed to seeing. There's actually many different regiments that had brown, green, blue. So we have attributed the blue coats to the Continentals, but in retrospect, you followed whatever your regiment was wearing. So you would get your regimental coat, you would get some breeches, stockings, footwear. If you were lucky, those things were hard to come by, footwear. You would be given a musket. The common musket to be given was, in the at least the early days of the war, was a Brown Bess musket. But as we continue to get more and more support from France, you'll see us switch over to the Charleville. The French Charleville was a very popular musket to be used at the time, and a lot of the American Continentals used that. So, a simple soldier carried his musket, his bayonet, a knife, a small haversack with some rations and personal items, maybe even a backpack. And that was all you had. That's what you lived with. You carried what you could, you slept where you could, and that's all you got. As the years in the war progress, we'll see shortages will really hit the Continental Army hard. Men will be without shoes. They'll have tatters for clothes. They're, you know, the only things that are really functional on them are their muskets. And it won't be until the Valley Forge winter that Baron von Steuben comes about and really transforms the Continental Army, gives them proper European training, shows them how to use the bayonet properly, shows them how to fight like soldiers. And we are definitely going to get to Valley Forge, the transformation of the Continental Army, and we are definitely going to be talking about Baron von Steuben. But for right now, he is a pivotal character that we are going to just save for when his time in the sun comes. Now, command structure was very simple. The commander-in-chief, George Washington, was equivalent to what is today a three-star general, a lieutenant general. The commander-in-chief was a three-star general. It's actually a big deal because it's not until the Civil War that we will see another three-star general take the field, and that's in the form of Ulysses S. Grant. Your division commanders, your department commanders, your occupation commanders will all be, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, be major generals. So we'll see several major generals. Some of the early ones are guys like Artemus Ward. Israel Putnam will become one, Philip Schuyler, Richard Montgomery, Benedict Arnold, the traitor himself, will be a major general. And there's going to be many, many more that we're going to talk about as the war progresses. But those are some of the most popular ones. So your major generals handled full divisions. When we talk about the Army of the Northern Department or the Eastern Department or the Southern Department, their commands will be headed by a major general because the commander-in-chief will have the main Continental Army with them, in whatever area he's fighting in. Now, they could also be used for occupation. When Benedict Arnold is in control of Philadelphia, he is a major general. So when a major general is needed to watch over an area that of importance, like Boston or Philadelphia or Charlestown. They were major generals. So that brings us to brigadier generals. What today is a one-star general? One-star generals during the American Revolution were in command of field commissions. They were field commanders. They were leading the troops in the battle. They were the ones that were out there on horseback leading their troops. So those were your brigadier generals. Your regiments were led by a colonel, seconded by a lieutenant colonel, and they had a third commander, which was the major. That was your basic command structure. And then your companies had captains, lieutenants, second lieutenants, so on and so forth. The next thing in the Continental Infantry I like to talk about is the flank companies. I've used that term flank companies several times when talking about the grenadiers and light infantry of the British Army. Flank companies for the Continental Army consisted of the light infantry and riflemen. Now, these two groups worked in unison. The riflemen were Indian fighters, backwoodsmen from the colonies of Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania. They were stout fighters, always itching for a fight. They carried rifles, Pennsylvania long rifles, Kentucky long rifles. They carried a rifle, and they used it with great effect. They were deadly at 300 yards with these things. They were good shots. Now, the reason I say that them and the light infantry work together is because with a rifle, there's something that it lacks, the ability to use a bayonet. And the light infantry had muskets, so they had the ability to use bayonets. And they were almost like a protection. So the riflemen would fire their long-range shots, picking off officers or any soldiers of importance. And when the infantry closed in to fight or drive them off with bayonets, the light infantry was there to absorb some of that blow. So the Continental Army was a unique system. You had your regiments from, you know, whatever state. A lot of the regiments were based out of the same area because it just made it easier. And a lot of men were comfortable with the fact that they could fight with their friends and neighbors. You know, you're not being placed in a different regiment with people you don't know from a different state. So the regiment system was something fairly simple. You took people from a general area and you put them together, whether it be squads, companies, whatever. And then the regiment formed from that. So your companies and squads were led – your squads were led by sergeants. Companies were led by lieutenants and captains. From your companies, you got your regiment. Your regiment was led by colonels, lieutenant colonels, and majors. You put the regiments together, you got full battalions that were led by brigadier generals. You put whole battalions together, you get divisions. Those were led by major generals. And that's the basic command structure, something very simple. Now, what does all good infantry need? Artillery support. Yes, every good infantry needs artillery support. And the artillery for the Continentals was actually formed from artillery units that were already there. The militias of that were forming in New England, and other colonies I'm sure as well, were forming artillery militia units as well. And those artillery units were being put together for the defense of New England by surrounding Boston, where the British were hanging out. And when Washington comes, that artillery is under the command of Richard Gridley. Now, we've talked about Richard Gridley. He was the chief engineer for the Battle of Bunker Hill. His son, Scarborough Gridley, was a major and had a battery of his own during the battle. Unfortunately, his son was being court-martialed for being deficient of command and cowardice during the battle. But anyway, the lackluster title of the artillery units had kind of earned them a bit of a bad name. So when Washington arrives, he sees over the course of his time and during the Siege of Boston, the aptitude that Henry Knox has had, not only in training and leading the artillery, but acquiring new artillery to join in the fight. He will appoint Henry Knox as commander of Continental Artillery. And in the beginning, the Continental Artillery was under command of one particular general, and it was known as, let's say, Knox's Artillery Regiment. That was one. Well, Knox's Artillery Regiment will turn into the 1st Continental Artillery. There will be a 2nd, a 3rd, and a 4th Continental Artillery. Those artillery units will then be stationed in different areas of the colonies. The 2nd Artillery was actually placed in the Eastern Department. The 1st Artillery followed Washington wherever he went. The 4th, I believe, was sent to the South. So these artillery regiments are being placed strategically throughout the colonies so that they are everywhere that they need to be in case the British invade or there's an impending fight with the British. Now, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Continental Artillery when that time comes. And that time is actually going to come a little sooner rather than later. For right now, I just wanted to give a brief overview of the Continental Artillery. The last thing I'm going to cover is the Continental Cavalry. The Continental Cavalry is something that they did not even expect to have. Washington, knowing that he was going to fight in around Boston and New York, in those northern colonies, he knew that the stone walls, thick woods, and narrow roads could totally nullify the advantage of cavalry. So the Continental Congress doesn't even decide on using a cavalry unit. It's not until the Battle of White Plains in 76 that Washington realizes the usefulness when he is bested by the 17th British Dragoons, and he now says, well, I should probably get some mounted troops. And he does have mounted troops for a little while. He actually has about 3,000 to 4,000 mounted troops for the beginning part of the war, but in March of 77, Continental Congress approves the formation of a Continental Cavalry Regiment. And like the artillery regiments, what they did was, or at least what Washington did, was take existing cavalry units and then turn them into the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. There was 4 regiments, just like there was 4 for the artillery regiments. So we have the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th cavalry regiments. Now, the 1st and 2nd were formed from the existing mounted cavalry that Washington had, and the 3rd and 4th are raised and formed later on. Once again, we are going to get very in-depth when talking about Continental Cavalry, because it's one of my favorite topics to talk about. The Continental Cavalry is just such a unique unit. There are times when they earn themselves some real street cred for some of the very brave things that some of these Dragoon units will pull off in various types of battles. So when we get to that, the year 1777 in the war, we are going to spend a lot of time talking about the formation of this Continental Cavalry. And both of these units, I'm not glossing over them and I'm not leaving them out. We're going to spend time, I'm going to explain the weaponry they carried, both artillery and cavalry. I'm going to talk about their uniforms, what it took to raise these units, and everything sort of like what I did with the Continental Army. But because in the timeline of events, and I'm following a particular timeline, the Continental Army was formed right around the time of Bunker Hill, I wanted to just concentrate mostly on the infantry portion, and we'll get to the artillery and cavalry later. So that's going to do it for this episode. It's actually longer than I thought. I was actually expecting a short episode this week, but I actually was on a bit of a roll and just kept kind of talking. But we are a day before Independence Day. So if you're listening to this in real time, I am recording this at 11 p.m. Monday, July 3rd. In just 46 minutes, it will be July 4th, Independence Day. So I got this episode out just on time. There will be a quick turnaround, as I also have an episode on the Commander-in-Chief George Washington that I'm planning for our next episode. And I wanted to do him in the next episode as a character study, because that is also our 25th episode. Now, as I'm numbering them, we are up to episode number 25 next week. I know that there are some episodes that have an A, B designation, so I have more than 25 episodes out there, but for all intents and purposes, we'll say this is episode 25. And with episode 25, it is also our one-year anniversary. I've been doing this for a year, and I have not kept up with it as much as I would like. Some life events have gotten in the way, and I've had to take some short breaks, so I'm very happy with everyone for, you know, keeping up with me. But July 7th starts a new year, and I'm going to try and keep to doing at the very least 3 episodes a month. If I can do 4 episodes, which would be one every week, I'll be happy. But if I get 3 out in a month, I'll be happy with that as well. So that's where we're going to leave off for this week. I have no recommendations for this week because this was just a general overview. There wasn't a lot of stuff that I pulled from exterior sources, so nothing I really need to cite. So this week we're going to go without a recommendation for reading material. I will say I want everyone to have a happy 4th of July. If you can make any of the various parades or make it to your local national park site, there's always a lot of fun they have during the 4th of July, so try and make it out there. Be safe if you're using fireworks, and try not to eat too many hot dogs. So that's going to do it for this week. If everyone could be so kind, if you are listening out there, I would really appreciate some 5-star ratings. This way, more people who are interested in the American Revolution can hear the good word. So as always, have a great week, and remember, keep your powder dry.